It's starting to seem inevitable that COVID-19, the disease caused by coronavirus, will turn up here in Juneau. What does that mean for us? And what will our lives be like when that first case is confirmed? I mean, it already feels a little bit different, doesn't it? Anyone been to Costco? I'm Jennifer Pemberton. I'm the managing editor for KTOO News. I'm here in our new studio for the next hour with some guests who are going to help answer some collective questions that we have about the virus and the disease that it causes and the social impacts it could have on us here in Juneau. I've got a couple of guests. First up, I have Adam Crum, who is the commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. And I can't imagine how busy you are these days. Have you stopped shaking hands with people yet?
Yes, I'm on the elbow tap now.
Yeah, it's like the latest dance craze, the elbow.
It's like the funky chicken.
The one-armed funky chicken. And Charlie Gribben is here from Bartlett Regional Hospital. Charlie, I have your title written down as infectious disease person. I don't think that's quite right.
Yeah, I am a nurse, but my title at Bartlett is infection preventionist. So I am responsible for maintaining good infection control and prevention habits and policies and procedures and monitoring disease and infection in the hospital.
Preventionist is a much better
term. I love it.
Later in the program, we're going to hear from Bridget Weiss. She's the superintendent of the Juneau School District, because if you're like me, you're probably wondering what the heck you're going to do with your kids if school gets closed. And finally, our city manager, Rory Watt, is here, who I know has also been extremely busy fielding questions. And then later in the program, we'll bring some of our reporters to talk about stories that they've been chasing related to this topic. I know that some of you are probably tired of answering the same questions over and over, but probably it's more like how we feel in the news business, which is like whenever there's a public information need, we actually get fired up about it. And that's part of why we put this program together. So I think we should probably start with what we kind of know right now and set the tone. And so I want to start with Adam, the commissioner. There are no confirmed cases in Juneau or the state. Is that correct?
That is correct.
As of this morning.
Yep. As of about an hour ago still.
Okay. And as far as testing goes, how many tests and Do you have those numbers?
Yeah, right now we are at 8 tests that came up negative, and we have 1 PUI, or person under investigation.
Okay. And Charlie, terminology is everything. So COVID-19 is the disease.
Right. Yes. The virus that causes the disease is SARS-CoV-2. And then it causes the disease named COVID-19 by the World Health Organization a couple weeks ago.
And coronavirus is generic, but we're kind of not using it that way anymore. Is that?
You know, the public comes up with its own name for what's going on, and it's a nice way to kind of keep the conversation going. But yeah, it does have a specific name, and the disease is called COVID-19, and the virus is SARS-CoV-2.
All right. Rolls right off the tongue, doesn't it?
I'm getting used to saying it.
So the majority of the it's a dozen deaths, I think, so far in the country. A lot of them have been in Washington State, which, even though we're separated by a whole other country, sometimes feels really, really close by for us. So, Charlie, what are symptoms of the virus? What should people be sort of looking out for if they're concerned about getting sick?
Yep, and I'm sure people have heard this before, but the symptoms of this respiratory virus is cough and fever. You may not even have a fever. Many people don't have a thermometer. So, you know, subjective fever, feeling hot, might want to check it with a cough. That's kind of the beginning symptoms. As it progresses, you can move into the lower respiratory. And so we're telling our nurses and doctors it's lower respiratory symptoms. And that's when you feel difficulty breathing, shortness of breath with a cough.
And are there populations that it's particularly dangerous for?
Yeah, that's who is most at risk is the elderly. People over age 65 is most at risk. Those people with comorbidities, that's already happening diseases in their body, like heart disease, diabetes, already existing respiratory diseases such as asthma or chronic bronchitis or COPD. And also heart disease. because a viral illness, as anybody has experienced one, like just a common cold or the flu, it puts the stress on your body. And we want people to be aware that this is a stress that if they get it and they have those comorbidities, we're doing our best to protect them.
And so we're hearing that people who have symptoms should probably call the hospital first before they just show up, or
definitely.
When should people show up at the emergency room?
Well, we want to address the fears in the community, and we want people to stay home, stay away from work when they develop symptoms of the common cold, so that they can stay home and take care of themselves and not spread whatever they've got. We are fielding calls right now from the public, but yeah, if you feel like you're developing a severe respiratory illness, or you're scared, you need some help, you're having trouble breathing, call ahead. The most effective thing we can do to prevent the spread of this illness is to put a barrier mask on. And that's just an ear loop mask that covers your nose and your mouth. And that's what will help us reduce the spread. So calling ahead is good. And then there's masks available at every doorway. And we'll put one on you and help you out.
All right. Commissioner.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that, particularly for state employees. We have access to Teladoc. And so for state employees and retirees, dial into Teladoc first if you have concerns or questions on that. I believe we're working on to make sure that copay is waived on that as well. So this is something that if you do have concerns, you can call and get access to a healthcare provider, because we want to make sure that healthcare system capacity is not overwhelmed. And so with Bartlett being a centralized regional hospital, we want to make sure that people can kind of rule out things first before they get there and overwhelm the hospital staff. We want to make sure that they have the capacity to deal with those really in need.
And Charlie mentioned masks. We had a listener question that was something along the lines of, why is our government telling us not to wear masks when other governments are sort of forcing people to wear masks? I don't know that that's – I think the terminology, like, forcing us to not wear masks is coming from the CDC that says if you're not sick, don't wear a mask, because there's kind of a run
right.
on masks. Can you talk a little bit about who
yes.
should be using a mask?
And this is part of that calming the fear, and we know what to do. We can handle infectious disease if we all do our part. So those people that are developing symptoms should wear a mask. So if you're sick, you should wear a mask when you're out in public, because that's going to minimize the spread of those respiratory secretions, spread in a cough or a sneeze, to getting onto a surface or into somebody's air that they breathe. So if you're sick and you're going to be around people, wear a mask. But if you're not sick and you don't need that type of protection, don't wear a mask, because hallways, buildings, being outside, you have good supply of fresh air, and that should be enough protection, as well as washing your hands and not touching your face.
Not touching your face. I feel like sort of wrapping my hands in some bandages to sort of prevent myself from touching my face. Like kids who bite their nails or pick their nose, you know, you wrap them up with
tape.
There
was an episode of Friends where Phoebe had to wear mittens because of chicken pox. So I do remember that.
Well,
we're not there yet.
No, we're not there yet. There have only been, we're in the lower double digits of deaths so far in the United States. And one of our listeners says that seems like a very small blip on the radar, especially when you compare it to deaths from the flu every year. So the question, and I'm going to toss this to Adam, is why the hype?
Yeah, the reason for the concern on this is we call the R-naught value, which is your likelihood as an infected person to infect other people around you. Because this has a relatively higher R-naught of 2.5, meaning that if you are infected, you can actually spread this to at least 2.5 other people. That is higher than the flu, and that is part of the cause of concern, is because while 80% of the people who do get this, it's very mild symptoms. There was even an op-ed in the Washington Post about an individual on one of the cruise ships who said, I have coronavirus and I'm quarantined. It's not that bad. But we want to make sure that we're being responsible for those at-risk compromised populations, those vulnerable populations, so that if you do have exposure to this or you are showing signs and symptoms, that we're not spreading it. We're trying to keep this as contained as much as possible.
Great. If you're just tuning in, I'm Jennifer Pemberton. This is a special program from KTOO News on coronavirus and COVID-19. Commissioner Adam Crum from the state and Charlie Gribben from the hospital are here in the studio. Charlie, you live and work in Juneau. What are some of your sort of daily routines and habits that you're examining and that maybe we should all be examining? I mean, should we all go to Costco on Saturday morning at the same time?
Large community gatherings are, you know, if you're getting a lot of people closer together, you're going to have a higher risk of spreading disease. So, I mean, that's the only day off I have is Saturday morning. So, but maybe go Saturday night and, you know, reduce your exposure to large amounts of people. But I don't really think we're there yet. As long as we do really good personal hygiene and keep ourselves not susceptible. You know, that's that epidemiological triangle. Like you have an agent that can spread, that can cause disease, and then you have the susceptible host. So if you're, you know, not stressed, getting good sleep, drinking lots of water, eating a balanced diet, you know, doing those good things that you know support your own health, we're gonna be all the better for it. And we might not be able to get that disease. We'll be able to stop the spread of the disease.
Great. We got a lot of questions from our audience about testing. I think it's on everybody's mind. So Adam, can you talk about, like, where are the testing facilities? Who's gonna get the test?
Yeah. So we have two state labs. One's in Anchorage and one is in Fairbanks. So the current test as it exists now is developed by the CDC, requires certain reagents. And so right now we have the capacity to test for 100 people in the state. More tests are coming in. We just received one shipment this week to increase our capacity. The reason why it's only at those two facilities is because it's a very specific test. It's a reverse transcriptase RNA PCR. And so not everybody has the technology in order to do that. We even saw that the University of Washington themselves was trying to do the test, and they actually had trouble with it, and they had to send their samples over to the state lab in Washington. So part of what the hope is sometime in the future that the CDC can actually help develop a quick test, like a lot of labs and hospitals can do now for influenza and RSV, that they can test via swab and do this in-hospital capacity. But right now, those samples have to come into the state lab. We have had individuals. There was a test in Ketchikan that took a couple days to get up to Anchorage. But once it was there, it was tested negative. But by the time it's in the lab, it's between 4 and 6 hours.
And so what are the current CDC guidelines for who gets those tests?
So the guidelines change all the time now. They've expanded that much broader. And so we change what we call our PUI, our person under investigation. Really, what we look at, and this is the updated stuff, is on our state website. If you really want to look, it's coronavirus.alaska.gov. This brings you to a main webpage where we've consolidated information specific for Alaska, also FAQs about travel protocols, what do you do at home, things like that. When we work on this, individuals who may be at risk because they have been in an exposed area right now would be coming either from China, from Northern Italy, recently traveled to Iran, for example, or if you had been in Bothell or Kirkland areas specifically, possibly in those areas that were exposed, you work with your healthcare provider. If they believe you're meeting the examples, they will reach out and contact the epidemiological team at the state, which is a 24/7 call center, to work with healthcare providers to rule out the risk factors. If an individual meets the criteria, then the sample is taken and it's sent in and we will test it.
I don't want to get too gross, but what is the sample?
Oh, the sample's not fun. It's a throat swab, mm-hmm. and as well as a real high nasal cavity swab. It's not comfortable.
Okay. So we shouldn't all be signing up to get a test just in case.
Yeah, and it's also really important. Dr. Zink, the chief medical officer, really stresses this. The test is not a cure. And so we do want to rule out a lot of other factors first. So things like influenza and RSV, which are going around the state. And so from our state perspective, what we're trying to do is we made sure our Medicaid program covers the testing costs of influenza and RSV, which can be done at your local clinics and hospitals. And so if you do have those signs and symptoms, we'd like to rule that out first before it elevates to the coronavirus or SARS-CoV-2 testing.
And as far as that test goes, who pays for that?
Right now, it's all on the state. We are paying for that. There is no cost to the individual to be tested for that.
Okay, great. I think before we take a break here, I want to talk about funding a little bit with the commissioner. I know the governor asked for additional state and federal funds this week. What would that money be used for?
So right now, we did an initial resource request on Friday. The governor asked us, what do you need from public health perspective to respond to this? We put together an ask, and we sent that to him, and we were talking with the governor over the weekend. He said, yes, let's fire away and do this. Then on Monday morning, we did get confirmation from our federal partners, and Vice President Pence did a call with all the governors, giving us a heads up about the federal package moving through. And so we knew that there was access to more federal dollars, so we increased our ask about what it is. Currently, we put in an ask for $9 million in federal receipt authority, meaning that if federal dollars come in the door, we can spend this on this response. Our initial ask was for 5 public health nurses. This is to add, and they would be based in our hub and spoke areas. But the goal is for systems, capacity building, and community engagement in our rural areas to go out to our rural healthcare primary care providers, clinics, to teach them about what to look for, how to help them screen out, to help them make sure, have they engaged at a local level on what to do if a pandemic were to break out? What is your contingency plan? We've asked for microbiologists just to help our lab staffing capacity, as well as emergency management response. And there's a couple other items. And, you know, backup in case a pool of funds, if there is a test and it can be moved to a hospital to do that, do we have dollars available to forward fund that testing in a local capacity? We just want to make sure we have this response. And again, this is an initial ask. Things are going to change. After we made that ask, I did get confirmation from the CDC an initial release of funds is going to be coming to Alaska, which is going to help cover all of those items as well. And we'll see what the federal package is, which is about $8 billion moving through Congress right now.
Right. So the a lot of that work, it sounds like, will be carried out by public health nurses. There's an article that came out in the Anchorage Daily News yesterday that state funding for these positions is down from a high in 2014, I think. So can this sort of, I don't know if it's called emergency funding, but this additional funding, is that going to sort of make up for years of budget cuts?
You know, that's a difficult question. We do think we do have capacity in the state to do this. So we're initially targeting, we've already got willingness from some retired public health nurses who have got extensive experience working in rural Alaska to come back into these roles. We did have a conversation with some Senate leadership yesterday. As we evaluate this, do we need to project out long-term positions? So we're not non-perm, as we call it, non-permanent. So that's a part of the conversation, just to make sure we have our capacity. We do have a very robust public health system in Alaska because of where we're at, having to deal with remote off-road systems all of the time. Last year in April, we did an event called Raging Contagion, which is actually every 3 years we do a massive event. This was dealing with an influenza pandemic. How do you move individuals in and out? How do you get test kits? And it's actual moving. So we had weather delays and things like that as we went through this drill. So we are as prepared as we can be. We'll see over time, but we think that this initial resource ask will help quite a bit, but we're just trying to make sure we're out in front, giving information as well as possible.
And I heard Dr. Ann Zink last night when she was briefing the legislature as the chief medical officer for the state about sort of being prepared for evacuations, because people are probably who need treatment will have to get flown. What do those preparations look like?
So we've broken out. So the State Emergency Operations Center within the Department of Health and Social Services has been activated since mid-January. Part of that, there are 9 separate task groups. One of them is a transportation. What do you do for these certain groups? And so we have interagency groups working with DMVA, Military Affairs, which oversees National Guard, in items like that. How do we transport personnel? How do we make sure that what limited supplies we have in the state are out to rural healthcare providers? Because they have first priority of any supplies that the state has.
And Charlie, I mean, we are sort of a rural, we're at least the hub where people might get evacuated to. Do you have a sense of, at Bartlett, at least what the preparations look like for sort of getting people here who are potentially infected?
Yeah, we have been in a lot of conversations about what that looks like because, yeah, our hospital and our emergency room staff depend on having reliable and speedy medevacs to help get sick people to a higher level of care. Because, yeah, while Bartlett is an excellent hospital, we don't have a cardiologist here. So we need to get people who have those severe medical needs to a higher level of care. Or, you know, somebody sick in Huna. We have helicopters. We've got these flights that go out regularly to bring sick people to us. And then we treat and evaluate whether or not they can stay at Bartlett or if they need to go somewhere else. So we've been in contact talking about how to protect those vitally important transport systems. CCFR has isopods that we're practicing using, which will contain, it's kind of like putting a person in a mask, but their whole body in a mask, so that, you know, the air that they breathe, and, you know, that it's a clear mask. It's not too claustrophobic, but
it sounds like one of those, like, bubbles. So, is it a bubble?
It's a bubble, yeah.
Okay. I was like, it's either that or a plastic bag, which I don't think is quite the right imagery.
It's ventilated, yeah. So we've been talking about how to protect, and, I mean, healthcare providers right now are doing their best hand hygiene ever, really, really meticulous about using PPE, that's personal protective equipment, very correctly and appropriately, and most important is taking it off. There's steps, and hand hygiene is part of each one of those steps, because after you take off your PPE, you have to take off your respirator, and we want you to do that with clean hands.
Right.
So because our healthcare providers are the most important thing here, you know, we really need to protect them so they can keep working.
I did that exercise in a first aid class where they put shaving cream all over your gloves, and you have to get your gloves off and get your equipment off without getting shaving cream everywhere, and then you realize, like, oh,
I have something even cooler. I have glow germ, and we're going to do an event sometime during Patient Safety Week to test nurses' ability to keep glow germ off of their hands and necks and faces.
Great. We're going to move on here, but I want to make sure that you guys have a minute to talk about anything that's on your minds that we haven't brought up yet that you think people need to know sort of immediately, Adam.
Yeah, I appreciate that. One of the things we'd like to keep in mind is be aware of the vulnerable population on this. This is our older than 65 population with co-occurring morbidities, lung disease, heart issues, diabetes, things like that. So if you are sick, if you do have a cold, if you have a fever, please don't go see grandma and grandpa. This is the opportunity to stay away. We're working across the board to make sure that Medicaid patients and insurance can actually have stocked up on prescriptions, things like this. So they have a supply. And this is one of those things that as of right now, there are no travel advisories. It's just be aware when you're traveling somewhere that if you have enough personal supplies on you to do with your normal medications, that you're doing that. We just want to make sure that we're responsible in taking care of these vulnerable populations. They're not putting them at risk unnecessarily.
And Charlie, I know people are, a lot of people go through SeaTac, and I've been hearing a lot of people being afraid of going through SeaTac to go anywhere. Do you have sort of, as you're with your infection preventionist hat on?
I have been fielding those questions.
Yes.
Because, yeah, like you said, we don't have a travel advisory right now. Be aware, wash your hands. I just learned that those vents above your head, I wanted to check that air circulation, because air circulation in an airplane is concerning for a lot of people. If they don't know the facts, they get scared. Turn on those gaspers. Turn that on, and that will push clean air past your face, and anything that you could breathe in will be on the floor. Wipe down the surface, wipe down your trays and your armrests, and then keep your hands clean, and you should be fine to travel.
So just be careful when you actually turn the thing on. You have to touch it, but then you're good.
Right. So. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Be conscious of all of those touches. Those we call them in the hospital high touch surfaces.
Right.
If you want a fun word of the day, it's fomite, which is a hard, solid surface, which actually the viruses can live on, like tabletops and door handles, things like that.
Fomite.
That's a fun word for the day.
It's not as fun as FOMO.
No.
Fomite. Got it. Well, thank you both so much for being here. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll come back with Rory Watt from the city and Bridget Weiss from the department of the school district. So thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And welcome back to this special program from KTOO News on coronavirus. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. I'm bringing in City Manager Rory Watt now and Bridget Weiss from the school district. And actually, we had one question on Twitter I want to address during the break, and that was for our epidemiologist, which was about the testing facility. So the labs are actually in Anchorage and Fairbanks, but you don't have to be in Anchorage or Fairbanks to get tested. So your local health facility can actually take that horrible deep swab and deep nasal cavity swab and send it to the state labs for you. So I wanted to make sure that we clarified that. And now I want to move on to sort of daily life in Juneau, how it might be impacted. And I want to start with Bridget. The school district is developing a plan to combat this virus. And have there been similar outbreaks in the past that have sort of been a model for this?
Yes, we have a leveled response built that we are adjusting for this specific situation. About 10 years ago, there was a pertussis breakout. There was also H1N1, people will remember. Those were a little different situation with some similarities, so we're taking our leveled response and adjusting it to the very specific pieces of the COVID-19 that we're learning. One of the biggest differences was in those situations, there were vaccines that we could use as part of our prevention, and so we encouraging people to be vaccinated was a large part of that. This is very different in that we don't have that yet. So we want to be very specific around this particular situation. So we're making those adjustments currently.
And so what is that, what are the levels? I don't know how detailed you want to get into it, but kind of just an overview of what that plan actually looks like.
Sure. We have four levels and we're currently in level one. Each level focuses on similar things, but at deeper levels, and then adds a few things. So we start with level one, where we are emphasizing hygiene, prevention and preventative measures. So re-emphasizing with our students, we have almost 4,700 students. And so that's a lot of people that we have access to ensure good preventative healthy habits. So, and we're also in our cold and flu season. So these are good practices no matter what. And so, but we're deepening those. So hand washing 20 seconds with soap and water. That's a very specific ask. It's different than washing hands.
Right.
We want that soap and water. We want it to last for 20 seconds. Making sure that students are reducing their touch from person to person as much as possible. We certainly are also adding some cleaning to our facilities. So we're adding layers of sanitization and deeper cleaning than we would normally do in our routine. So those are some critical pieces. And then communication. So adding communication to our families. We've sent all families a letter explaining what we're watching for and what our ask is of them.
Yeah, because I think what's really interesting about this disease, and we didn't get into this when our epidemiologists were here, but it doesn't seem to be affecting children as much, or they're not as symptomatic from what we know so far. So it's, these are kids who are not getting sick and not experiencing this. Is that a sort of harder sell for communicating about how to stay clean?
I think with this particular situation, because it has been so public and such a national conversation, that people are taking it seriously. In addition, we have vulnerable children with medical needs, as well as adults, our elderly with health vulnerabilities. And so we really want to do our due diligence in helping our kids and our staff create and maintain those healthy habits.
And so what is the sort of new education, or maybe it's not new, but this sort of re-upped education on cleanliness look like for kids?
Well, it is, again, hand-washing habits. And so another thing we've asked is that staff, especially at our elementary schools, build those things into the routine structures versus hoping that kids do that on their own. So it really isn't a lot of new. It is the same levels of preventative measures, coughing, sneezing. In the last few years, people have really attain the habit of using their elbow to cough or sneeze into versus their hand. So some of these are things that we've already become habit forming, but re-emphasizing those is really important. The other piece is just recognizing what potential symptoms are and paying attention to that, where normally we might have adults, parents calling in to tell us their child is sick for the day. Now we're asking parents, can you describe the symptoms that your child is having? And that way we just have a little deeper layer of understanding if we end up having a higher absentee rate somewhere in the district.
And are you using students as little emissaries of information? Are you sending stuff home with them?
We've communicated with all families via a letter earlier this week, and we will maintain that level of communication both with all staff and with parents as we go. So this is, as you know, a very rapidly changing situation. So we feel constant and communication is important because we're getting new information every day. So we want to keep it on people's mind and radar and make sure that they know what we know and what we're emphasizing with their children.
And I don't want to focus on worst case scenarios mm-hmm. at this point, but going back to sort of the levels and the plans, you know, where is school closure? Where is the sort of more dramatic steps?
Sure. That is definitely would be a level 4 response as we work our way through the layers. We have stages to get there. We could, as an example, begin some of that social distancing by asking our volunteers and others that are not required at a school site to not come in. We could cancel events. We could design events in a different way. So there's a lot of stages to get to that point. School closure is a huge impact on our families. It's a huge impact on our overarching goals of the district. So making that decision is always challenging in any situation, and we will do that with great cause and great collaboration. So that's not a decision I would make in isolation as the superintendent. I would be in contact with our public health organization, the city manager, to talk about all kinds of details surrounding that if we end up getting to that point.
And I know a lot of adults right now are sort of at least thinking about the potential to work from home, or if they mm-hmm. is there a student equivalent of working from home? I mean, is distance ed an option or something that you guys are talking about at all?
We are talking about it. The reality of doing that for 4,700 students is really complicated.
It's a lot of laptops.
A lot of laptops, a lot of hotspots, wireless connectivity that a family may or may not have. So we are working on what that might look like, but the reality of us really having a thorough plan in place by the end of the school year is probably not likely. So we're looking at intermittent types of options. Another big consideration for us is that many families rely on us for breakfast and lunch for their children. And in a more extended closure of schools, that would be impacted. So we're also devising some plans, starting to come together to look at what we could do in that situation and how we could support families outside of the school building in that way. So there's just a lot of layers that we would want to look at to support our families and our kids if we got to that point.
Yeah, and that seems sort of complicated. And I know that, you know, that's why we have plans and levels and things. Mm-hmm. And I want to sort of take that to Rory and sort of what does that look like at the city level, sort of for the general population?
So I want to talk about what we call all hazards planning. So we have a number of staff members who worry about the big one, and whatever the big one might be, we participate in the incident command system and we train ourselves. So if we have a major emergency event, we would do what we would call stand up the emergency operations center. And we would organize ourselves around that federal system. And we call it all hazards planning because we don't know what's coming. We don't know if it's an avalanche or an earthquake or, you know, and whether it's a wildland fire that we don't have here. That response infrastructure organization is essentially the same. We also would have a unified command. So since it's that federal system, the Coast Guard, the public health officials, we're all in that system together. So depending on the level of response that's necessary, it adapts. And the incident commander might be the captain of the port for the Coast Guard. It might be the chief medical officer for the state. It might be the CDC. It all depends. So we're organized to respond to emergencies. So in this case, this public health crisis, emerging pandemic, whatever you want to call it, we are participating with our local emergency planning committee, and we're coordinating all those activities so that if we need to stand up that emergency center, we're ready.
I've seen a lot of long Facebook posts and information from the city and CCFR. We'd have one listener comment / question is, communities fall apart in this kind of hysteria. What are city officials doing to dispel misinformation and keeping people safe? You're here, aren't you?
I am.
That's part of it. I feel like, you've been out there getting information out. But how would you sort of address, you're actively trying to do?
So we're actively trying to communicate calm but informed concern. COVID-19 is a very serious disease, and we absolutely should be concerned about it and doing everything that we can to limit the transmission. We should assume it's coming, and our everyday actions should respond appropriately. So we all should be having hand-washing competitions. Mm-hmm. We should all be challenging ourselves to touch our faces less. We should be cleaning shared surfaces. We should be doing all those things as a community so that when the commissioner was talking about the R-naught, how much it transmits, I want the Juneau R-naught to be as close to zero as possible. And I want individual people in Juneau to think of themselves as they could be the person that washes their hands one more time that limits the spread. They could be the person that doesn't touch their face and they don't get infected so that somebody else doesn't get infected. They could be the person that washes that countertop in that public area of their workplace and that disease spreads one last time. And maybe they're a healthy person and maybe they're not personally worried, but maybe they could be the person that stops the spread to our vulnerable populations.
And I think because Juneau is, we're used to natural disasters, avalanches, tsunamis, earthquakes, we're sort of prepared for that. I think the last time I saw the rankings, Alaska is second to Utah in sort of the number of preppers and people who are prepping for these sort of situations to happen. What about the sort of, panic shopping and the run on supplies and people? I mean, people, I think, are taking that very seriously. Does the city have any sort of messaging or any thoughts on stop buying all the hand sanitizer or just on, advising people on how to prepare for this? Because we're all thinking about potentially staying home for a while.
I think the message has to be we are all in this together. And panic doesn't help. Good information does. Informed concern does. Sure, you can raid the supplies of the hand sanitizer, but the public health officials are telling us soap and washing your hands for 20 seconds is best. And so to the extent that we can all focus on the science and the messages from the public health officials, I think we're better off instead of reacting out of fear.
And a similar question that I asked the superintendent, and that's, not to dwell on worst case scenarios, but when do things like the pool and the library and the buses, when do things sort of we consider closures in the city and city functions?
Absolutely. So, and I think the answer to, in short, is when it's appropriate. We are not seeing any reason why that would make sense at this time. But we're certainly talking about that. We have a lot of public facilities and we have a lot of public gatherings. So we absolutely need to be considering, we've got gold medal coming up. Should we be thinking about canceling gold medal? We should be thinking about it, and whether we should or not, it's a good question. We've got the folk festival coming up. We should be thinking about that. On Monday night, we're going to be doing another town hall meeting in the assembly chambers at 6:00. And people that are interested, we're encouraging to listen on the radio and practice social distancing. But absolutely, we have any number of public services, and we're thinking about it. But the science and the public health officials are not telling us that it's appropriate to close those facilities and events. at this time.
Phew. I mean, I need to get my exercise at the pool in order to stay healthy. So that's what I wanted to hear.
But what I want you to hear is that we're watching. And if we think that it's appropriate, we're going to close those facilities, but not at this time.
Great.
So it's that measured concern. We're not writing it off, and we're not panicking.
Speaking of panicking, I know that cruise ships are on everyone's mind, and we're going to get into that in a second. But before we take a quick break, I want to ask the superintendent one more time, just anything that we didn't address that you think is important for our population to know right now.
I would add that our general health and well-being is really important, and we are so blessed to live here in Juneau in this environment. So the healthier we are as individuals, the less susceptible we are to carrying something or sharing a virus. So we have this amazing place. People need to be continuing their activity to stay healthy. You mentioned swimming at the pool. Go outside. Lots of fresh air. That's our asset. So we want to keep people healthy in general so that our hospitals, as an example, have more capacity to support anyone who might need a deeper level of care in our capacity at Bartlett. So just really encouraging people to maintain those healthy habits, to encourage them with their children, and stay healthy. Do the things. Stay active. Get outside and keep yourself deeply using these preventative measures, because that is our best strategy, is the prevention.
And hopefully the weather will cooperate with
correct
with that advice.
Spring is coming.
We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to bring some of our KTO reporters here who are working on answering your burning cruise ship questions. And we'll keep the city manager here as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to KTOO's special program on coronavirus preparation here in Juneau. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. We've still got City Manager Rory Watt in the studio, and I've also brought in reporters Adeline Baxter and Jeremy Shea.
Hi.
Hello. Don't think your guys' mics are on yet. We're working on it. So thanks for being here. So earlier this week, Adeline reported on the Westerdam coming to Juneau, and Adeline, what is the story with the Westerdam, and why are people freaking out about it?
Well, Rory could tell you just as well as me, but basically Holland America is looking for a place to put its ship, waiting for its Alaska season to start up. The Westerdam was turned away from several ports in Asia due to fears about coronavirus. This was at the same time as the Diamond Princess, so it was sort of an abundance of caution, from what I understand, on the part of several port cities. So there was at one point a passenger who did test positive on the boat. They have since tested negative. So Holland America Line has maintained that was actually a false positive. It's not completely clear, at least from like American sources, what exactly the situation was there. But that all passengers have left the ship. The last passengers left on February 19th. So it's just about 700 crew right now. It's currently transiting the Pacific on its way to Hawaii. Holland America says the ship is being thoroughly cleaned during that trip, and then will have to go through additional clearances once it reaches Hawaii before being given the go-ahead to continue on to Juneau, where it should arrive on or around March 22nd.
Right, to adoring fans.
Mm-hmm. For about 2 to 3 weeks stay.
Okay. And before I get a reaction here from the city manager, I want to play a little clip from Jeremy's upcoming story about port safety in light of coronavirus. And Jeremy talked to Juneau resident Deb Rodriguez and asked about the Westerdam, and this was her reaction.
I mean, my first reaction is, why, when other countries have turned it away, who made this decision? And was this decision thought through? Do we have what we need?
And I've seen a lot of comments along this line on social media. So, Rory, how involved were you in the decision-making process behind bringing the ship here? And, you know, just address what's not a rhetorical question is, should we be concerned?
Absolutely. So there are a lot of people that believe and have written me that I personally approved this idea without consultation. The facts of the matter are is that it's a private ship, and as we understand it, it was cleared by the CDC, and it's coming here to a private dock. So based on all of the information we have, I see no reason that we should be concerned, and that is in the context of the risks that we currently face. And the risk that we face, as I see it, is we have substantial aviation traffic in and out of our airport. We get 700,000 people go through the Juneau Airport every year. Of course, Seattle is our hub. And the Westerdam, so circling back, the Holland America advised me that this was their plan. And I said, based on the information I have, I'm not concerned about that. Now, of course, if that information changes, maybe our response would change. But we have no information on why we should be particularly concerned about the Westerdam. We have a lot of information that makes us concerned about transmission of the disease from the Seattle area. And if that's going to happen, it's going to be through our airport. And I guess the context is if we have 500 or 700 crew members on the Westerdam, and they have doctor and nurses, and they're traveling across the Pacific at 4 knots, and they're going to be here in 3 weeks, and every day we have 800 or 1,000 people coming into the airport. I want to focus on the people coming into the airport and individuals in the community doing good hygiene to stop the potential spread.
Someone on Facebook asked us if there were any plans to screen people at the airport. Is that something we have any jurisdiction over? Is that a decision on Homeland Security?
So as a practical matter, I don't know how you could do that. So would you, if you wanted to screen people for coronavirus, we just heard Commissioner Crum say you've got to fly to Anchorage and it takes 6 or 7 hours.
And we have 100 tests.
Yeah, we have 100 tests statewide. So we cannot screen everybody at the airport. What we can do is focus on what the public health officials and the scientists are telling us. And we can focus on that hand washing. We can focus on that social distancing. And we can focus on staying home from work if you're sick. And we can focus on sending employees home if they're sick. We can focus on all those things.
And so sort of feeling comfortable with the Westerdam coming here, knowing that it's been cleared and that it's only got crew. Another question that we got was, you know, if a cruise ship shows up in Juneau with an infected passenger or passenger with, you know, coronavirus on board, will those passengers be allowed to get off the ship?
And that is a great question, and that's exactly the kind of thing that we're focusing on right now. So cruise ships with passengers arrive in Juneau in the middle of April, and so we're doing that planning right now to set up exactly what are the protocols, how do we handle this, who's going to make that decision. And I can, you know, while I can't tell you exactly what that's going to be, that's going to be in consultation with Dr. Zink and the state and whatever the CDC is saying. We're not going to be making up the Juneau theory of the afternoon. We're going to be working to have those protocols established at the start of cruise ship season, which is only a couple weeks after the Westerdam will be here. So to me, it's probably not best directed to focus efforts on thinking about the Westerdam crew. It's best to focus on the upcoming cruise ship season, if you're interested in cruise ships, or it's best to focus on the risk that we face here today in the community.
And Jeremy's been looking into sort of who has the power to turn ships away and what that looks like. Jeremy, what have you learned about those superpowers.
Right. So there's a role in the Coast Guard, and there's one guy who covers all of Southeast Alaska who has this role called Captain of the Port. Coincidentally, his rank in the Coast Guard is also Captain, so there's a little confusion there. And his name's Captain Stephen White. He's based here in Juneau, and he has a power. I listened in on a briefing, actually, with the Visitor Industry Task Force about this position, and he said he's supposed to use the power judiciously, and he kind of put it in the context of safety threats, you know, threats to public safety. So I wasn't able to sit down with him and ask him directly, you know, and does that apply to public health? But it feels like from the context I had and from his presentation and the research I've been doing that, yes, that is within his power to turn specific ships away if there's a public safety threat.
So and I'll follow up on that. So I think everybody is following the news and saw what Governor Newsom did last night in California and turned away a cruise ship, and you know they flew test kits out there. We might get to that point, and I think what people need to know is that Captain White has jurisdiction, but our governor, in consultation with Dr. Zink, has that ability as well. And we as a community, we have that ability as well. We could declare a civil emergency, and we can make that decision. But we see no reason to act rashly, but we are organizing ourselves because this is clearly an emerging public health crisis.
It's worth noting that the ship involved in California is the Grand Princess, which does visit Juneau in the summertime.
The other implications to the cruise ship season, there are several of them. But I know, Adeline, you've been looking into sort of scheduling, and I was hearing a rumor pretty early on that, you know, ships besides the Westerdam might be coming early, that the season might be starting early. As cruise lines are canceling sailings in other parts of the world, is that having an impact on the industry here?
Mm-hmm. And from what the people I've spoken to in the industry, the most likely scenario is not ships coming early because obviously not a lot of tourist activities are open before end of April, early May. But what we're more likely to see is more companies sending more of their boats to Juneau earlier in the season. So redirecting, for example, many companies have canceled sailings in Asia out of an abundance of caution. Norwegian Cruise Lines has done that, but from what I've been told by an executive there, they are not planning on adding any additional sailings in Alaska right now. They're going to actually be sending one of their boats to the Greek Isles. But at the same time, the Celebrity Millennium is adding extra sailings here. So it's decisions being made at the top level at various companies, and a lot of them haven't really confirmed those decisions yet. But we're also seeing impacts. There's been reporting that cruise lines are seeing lower numbers of passengers right now, of people putting off their vacations maybe a little bit, just waiting to see what happens. So at the same time, cruise lines may be offering lower fares. So it remains to be seen what the impact's going to be locally.
Yeah, I've been thinking about the, you know, the Visitor Task Force has been working on this idea of, you know, the dirty word of over-tourism, or just like at what point do we need to sort of think about how fast this industry is growing here in Juneau. Is that conversation moving towards what if we don't get as many passengers this year as we thought we were going to? Rory, is that something that anybody's worried about yet?
Absolutely. So down at City Hall, we're doing our revenue forecasting and looking at our budgets, and if we have a dip in economic activity, then we're going to have to respond to that. I'll just to follow up on some of those questions. I would remind everybody that this is a disease that's spreading from person to person. It's not a cruise ship specific disease. So again, focus on the good hygiene. I do have some information that I think we may see additional sailings in early May. Those are not confirmed. You know, you can watch the news by the hour and you see the stock market dips in the airline companies and the sales on airline tickets. And I think it's a dynamic situation. And the best that we can do for people is remind them of what they personally can do to limit the spread. and to follow our public health officials' advice.
I spoke to several kind of seasonal tourism workers just to get gauge their reaction, and there's a range. You know, one guy wanted a total shutdown of the cruise ship season and said that should be being discussed. You know, other people were pretty at peace with the level of risk because they, you know, interact with people all day already, and there are other transmissible diseases that move the same way as this coronavirus and you know, norovirus and the flu and colds and things like that. And they said they're not to be flip, but they said, you know, they're more concerned about if the numbers are lower, how that affects their wages and tips this summer, because they're already taking precautions from getting other nasty bugs.
And I have one more listener question, which we've kind of already addressed, but I want to make sure that we answer it specifically. And it's about the seasonal workers who are about to show up in Juneau from all over the country and potentially from other countries. The question is there talk about testing people like that, which we know that we have a limited number of tests, so maybe that's not the right question. But are we concerned about this influx of not just tourists, but the seasonal workers who are going to be in our community potentially for the, you know, for the whole summer?
I'm concerned about everybody, right?
Yeah.
Every one of us travels about the town. And like I said, we have 700,000 people come through our airport a year. You know, that's a lot of movement of people. We have to assume that the virus is on the move, and that if it's not here already, it will be here. And we have to assume that the best thing that people can do is lots of individual actions to limit the spread, and to do everything we can to not overwhelm our public health systems.
And we have just about a minute left in the program. So is there anything, I think, Rory, that we haven't talked about that we can cover besides reiterating? I mean, we can keep bringing the hammer down.
All right. It's a community challenge, right? Challenge yourself to wash your hands. Couple strategies. Try not to touch your face. Try not to move that disease from your hands to your face. Keep tissues in your office. Have hand toys. Wash your hands. Don't touch your face.
I just touched my face while you were saying
that. I know. I scratched my cheek earlier. Yeah. Try. Social distancing from vulnerable people. Do what we can so that we are a model community in the way that we respond to the threat.
Reporters, anything else you've learned that's been interesting that we can make sure we share now?
I would just encourage the public to keep reaching out directly to their city officials and to reporters from trusted, you know, sources. Obviously, the conversation can get a little out of hand sometimes on social media, so it's important to check in with, like, trustworthy sources.
And Monday night, the city is hosting a similar conversation starting at 6 o'clock.
6 p.m., and you'll be broadcasting it. And practice your social distancing and listen on the radio.
Stay home. And listen to it. Mm-hmm.
The city will not be taking public comment anyway.
And if you have questions, email them to boroughassembly, all one word, boroughassembly@juneau.org, and we'll answer them on the air and in writing.
Great. We're going to get ready to sign off here and disinfect all of our mics and buttons and all of that. I'd like to thank all of our guests. We had Adam Crum from the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services earlier, and Charlie Gribben from Bartlett Regional Hospital, Bridget Weiss from the Juneau School District, Rory Watt, Juneau City Manager, and KTO reporters Adeline Baxter and Jeremy Shea. Thank you guys so much.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And thanks to those of you who submitted questions. Rasha McChesney and Cheryl Snyder helped produce today's show. We'll have video of this conversation available on our website later today. There will be a rebroadcast of this program tonight on the radio at 7 p.m. if you missed it or want to tell any of your friends. We are covering this topic extensively at ktoo.org. This is KTOO Juneau 104.3. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. Thanks for listening.